Om Gyanatimirandhasya Gyananjanashalakaya Chakshurin Militam Jaina Tasmai Shri Gurave Nama Shri Chaitanya Manobhistam Sthapitam Jaina Bhutya Shayam Rupa Kada Mayam Dukhati Shapanantika. Okay, we'll see how much we can tell you about BBT within the space of an hour, something like that. Can you all hear in the back? No. Why don't we move the front closer to the front, and then the back will be closer to the front. You've got all this real estate over here, too, that you can use. They don't charge extra. Yeah, you can be here. Now we can hear? If I'm too soft sometimes, tell me to speak up, and I will. Get lazy sometimes. I'm not sure what all you're going to want to hear about, so if at some point there's something that I'm talking about that interests you and you want me to say something more about it, or I'm not getting to something that you want to hear about, speak out. I'm not very super structured today, so you can do that. I'll start off with a little history and bring it up, that little history, a little bit of theory, ideals, and bring things up to present, and we'll see where we are. BBT, Srila Prabhupada's spiritual master famously told him, if you ever get money, print books. If you ever get money, print books. Prabhupada said, this I learned from my Guru Maharaj. He said, everything else practically I learned from my father. You know, how to do bhajan, how to do festivals, puja. But he said, this I learned from my Guru Maharaj, how to print books. He was very fond of books. So we know that Prabhupada began in India publishing books. His godbrothers were mostly building temples or doing something else. But Prabhupada was writing and going to Delhi and going through so much trouble to publish his Bhagavatams, that you know. And then came to America with his trunks of books, and he was supporting himself, practically speaking, by going around to bookstores or here and there and selling his books. Then in 1967, maybe? Maybe 66 even, he started Back to Godhead. He took the total money that was there in the treasury and spent it on two funky presses and had the devotees begin the Back to Godhead. Then his next book was Teachings of Lord Chaitanya, which he printed in Japan. And gradually, things were becoming ISKCON Press. The devotees, when I first came in 1968, there were two or three devotees who were learning the printing trade. They were working for printers in New York City with the idea that they would be able to start a press for Srila Prabhupada. Then, meanwhile, in Ohio, Hayagriva Prabhu, who, as you may know, was a professor of English literature at Ohio's associate professor of English literature at Ohio State University, was editing, and his wife became the first composer. Composer means typesetting, which now everybody does on their laptop or something similar. But back in those days, most typesetting was done with something called a linotype machine, which involved keyboarding and turning out a stick of actual type, physical letters made out of lead. They were called hot lead because it was molten lead and it was formed into letters. And these were made into pages and physically pressed onto paper. And that's how books were done back then. But an alternative to that way of doing it, which was how printers all over New York were set up to do it, were these little machines called IBM composing machines, which was a kind of a glorified typewriter which could justify columns of type, make them come out even on both sides. And they cost $5,000 a piece, which was a pretty penny back then. Still not cheap. And they did the job. You got pages typed up, and you'd photograph the pages, and then from the photographs you would make negatives, and from the negatives you would go to lithography, the printing as we more or less know it these days. So that machine was purchased in Ohio, and then gradually things drifted over to Boston because they found a building there that was a large building, a former, we always have these colorful buildings. That one was an old funeral home. And it had a nice landing, which you could use for unloading paper and stuff. And it was, of course, where they used to unload former people. And we purchased a press, a physical printing press, and some bindery equipment down in the basement, and some photography equipment to photograph the pages. These were not photographs like photographs, but black negatives with clear where the type would be. And which you then, it always had these little holes in it, little white specks that you had to paint over so that it wouldn't shine through. So we had a dark room there for developing a big camera for shooting these pages, and then developing equipment and binding equipment down in the basement. And that was the beginning of ISKCON Press. You were there in Boston.
Not in Boston.
You joined in Brooklyn.
In New York.
Okay, so I'll bring the at when we get there. So on this press, we printed a few issues of BTG. Isha Upanishad was first printed there. Easy Journey to Other Planets. Maybe a couple other small books. And Second Canto Srimad Bhagavatam, which Prabhupada had us do in chapters, because he didn't want us to, you know, one day, sometime in the future, come out with Second Canto. So this way he put it on his schedule. Every, you know, however often, you know, 2 days to do this, 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 and then you're done with a chapter, and you print it. So we printed these little Second Canto chapters as individual books, and then at the end you have it all so you can make a full volume. That's how the Second Canto was done. Nectar of Devotion was first printed, the first large book printed on ISKCON Press. The color was printed there too. You have to used to have to put a page through the press 4 times to get the 4 colors. And there was something called registration, which meant getting it going through the same trajectory each time, so that you didn't get people with purple eyebrows and things like that, which we saw a number of. So that came out. It was not entirely successful, because when the books arrived, say in Los Angeles where Prabhupada was, you'd open them up and the binding would crack and the pages would fall out. So it had mixed success. But it was a first. Let's see what else we'll tell you about. The art department started in Boston, and when I first got there, the devotees, they were sitting, and they got everything first, because Prabhupada would send his tape dictations to Boston. Satsrup Maharaj would be the transcriber, and then Jadurani would make crude tape recordings of them, you know, just play the dictation machine next to a microphone. And so that's how we have these Krishna book dictation tapes preserved. And they used to, the artists would sit and listen to Prabhupada and paint. Jadurani and a few other devotees, Janava, who's from Alachua? No one? So you know Mother Janava? So she was there as one of the first girls painting. And a few other devotees, gradually Bardraj Prabhu, came up there, Merlihard make it up to Boston? I don't know. But gradually it started forming, and you got this team of Murlidhar, Parikshit, Jadurani, the team that did most of the paintings, actually, in Prabhupada's, for Prabhupada's books. So that was going on in Boston also. Then we moved back down to New York. There was a the press devotees, that's the people who were running the press, who were sort of running things, brought things back down to New York. We had our temple in Brooklyn, not so far from the present Brooklyn Temple, in fact, about a 20-minute walk or so, not very far from the waterfront. And we had a building closer to the waterfront, about a, well, it was a 3-minute walk in the summer and a 15-minute walk in the winter. Real quick walk at 3 in the morning. Which had the ground floor had the press equipment, and then upstairs we had the artists and the typesetting and the editing and layout and everything else going on upstairs. And that was a lot of fun, because the Brooklyn Temple was a lot of fun back in those days. We really had a good time. Anyone who was back in Brooklyn will tell you what a good time we had there. And we developed quite a serious operation up there on Tiffany Place, it was called. You might sometimes see a book that says ISKCON Press, Tiffany Place. So that sounds like a very glorious address. It was actually like a real seedy waterfront area. And we used to have always a couple of devotees who would stay there every night doing what we called loft watch, which meant watching against break-ins, which sometimes did occur, so that we didn't get ripped off of everything. So there'd always be somebody sleeping out there every night. Mama, do you want to tell how the composition was done, how the typesetting was done?
I wanted to mention that there was, at one point, there was round the clock, 24 hours shifts on those composing machines.
Yeah. We got two of them. We invested in a second one, and I think they were both going 24 hours.
Yeah. So we would, and I was one of the ones when I first went there that worked at night. So right before Mangal Arati, you'd have to go wake up a brahmachari to walk us back to the temple.
We would go 4 to 8, 8 to 12, and 12 to 4. So if you were working, say, 12 to 4, it meant midnight to 4 a.m. and noon to 4 p.m. That's how it worked. So 8-hour days on 2 4-hour shifts. And we had three such people on each machine, so they were both working 24 hours a day, which the machines absolutely were not meant to do. And they were IBM machines, so they were on an IBM service contract. How often did we see the repair guys there?
Pretty often.
Sometimes it was like every couple of days they'd be out there. We definitely got our money's worth from those machines. When we retired them, one guy said, "This machine doesn't owe you anything." You want to tell how you did the composing, what was involved?
It was pretty laborious, as I remember, because if you made a mistake, it was kind of a big deal to fix it. I can't remember, you had the backspace or something.
Okay, I remember. The first thing you did is, of course, you had a manuscript sitting next to you, and while you're looking at the manuscript, you're touch typing, right? So you're looking, and you type a whole page, and as you type, there's a little bar which is showing a color and a number. And you get to the end of the line, and you tab over, and you type the color and the number. Like if it's yellow 2, you type Y2. And then the next line, if it's W6, you type a W6. And those colors and numbers indicate how much space the machine is going to have to put between each word. That's what they're there for. Yellow was a lot of space. I think blue was kind of tight. So you went through and typed the whole page that way, Then you got out your good paper. That was scrap paper. Then you got out this good paper, which had like clay on the top and would cost like, I forget how much per sheet. It was ghastly expensive. And you put that through. And this time you typed so that that didn't make any mistakes, because this page was going to be photographed. So every page got typed twice. That's only the beginning. You have to have Roman bold and italic, right?
Yeah.
Now you just type control I, no way. There's these little golf balls, maybe you might recall, these little golf balls that have type on them. Yes. So when you're going to go from Roman to italic, you just change golf balls. Yes. Like word for word meanings. Right?
Changing the font.
Changing the font physically by hand, like six times in a line. We're not done yet. There's diacritic marks.
Yeah.
We had to get custom golf balls made. There was only one place that we knew of in the world, Cadwell Corporation in Honolulu, Hawaii, which for a pretty penny would modify, you know, take out a character and put in a new character. So if you wanted like a dot, they would give you a dot. Now, some things, they were unique. So say an M with a dot over it, that dot was only over an M. So you could put the whole thing as one. But if you wanted a dot under a letter, like a D, a T, and an H, they went under all those letters. Now you weren't gonna waste three precious letters off your golf ball. So you put just one for the dot. And then you do something like D, half backspace to get to the middle, type your dot, then go forward again. Right? Am I lying?
I'm beginning to remember, yeah.
The R, as I remember, with the dot under it was a particular challenge. Anyway, at the end of the day, you got all your diacritic marks in. You got all your words in the right typeface. And you didn't make any typing mistakes. Because a typing mistake meant one of two things. If there were too many on a page, you'd do the whole page again, because that was the easiest thing to do. Or if it was just an occasional one, you'd redo a couple of lines, and the layout men would take your new lines and paste them over your old lines. That's how the pages were done. Oh, that's how the type was done. Then some guys with light tables, you know what light tables are.
It's they had a hard job, too.
Oh, yeah, they had a lot of fun. A light table was professionally one thing, but in our version, it was a couple of pieces of wood tacked together with some fluorescent lights put underneath, and then some frosted glass on top. And then you had these sheets of paper with lines on them showing where your margins would be, where your lines would be. Everything's there. And now you take your text that's been so nicely typeset and you paste it down on top of the lines, you know, looking through and seeing how everything is. And in the early days, you did it with rubber cement, if I remember. And then we got
razor blades.
Oh, yeah, definitely razor blades, because you have to cut all this to size. And then rubber cement, getting it where you want it, and finally pasting it down. And then we got fancy. We found a waxing machine, which waxed the back of the paper and gave it like little tiny little studs so that you could pick it up and put it down again and hope you didn't get wax all over the place. But it was a big advancement for the layout people. The Yamaraj Prabhu, who's working it back to Godhead, is a veteran of those days. And several other devotees were working in the layout department. And also you hoped that they got the right sheets in the right order and got all those little lines to paste on top of the right lines and all of that stuff. So that's how the layout was done in those days. Everything by hand. The little line. Yeah, you type out a whole page of purport.
And then have to cut it.
And they have to cut it, center it.
Yeah, yeah.
Did the kind of learning go on, happen as?
Yeah, everybody was learning on the spot. You know, we'd learn things from the, we used to attend printing shows and we'd find out about ways to do things and new, like the waxing machine somebody showed me at a printing show. And, you know, I bought it on the spot. He said, yeah, you know, there were two companies and one was the big company. He was the small company. He said, mine's better and take it and try it. And if you don't like it, you can send it back. So I took it and it was actually better. It was great.
I mean,
fantastic.
You were overseeing all that.
I was up. Yeah, I was the production manager upstairs.
Yeah.
And then there were two devotees who were the managers downstairs. Yeah. So that was all going on at ISKCON Press. And then one devotee joined Radha Ballava from Florida, who was the Tulsi Pujari and graduated from Tulsi Pujari to the production manager. And he was quite good, actually. He was a much better manager than I was. And all this was going on in the East Coast, and on the West Coast, Karandar Prabhu, who was a devotee in charge of a lot of things in those days, was managing the printing and warehousing and so on. No, not the printing. The printing we were doing, but at a certain point, we stopped printing down there. Let's see if I'm getting ahead of myself on my outline. We stopped printing because, among other things, we were, the quantities started getting big. In the beginning, it's like we were printing these books, but how to distribute them? Devotees would, they'd go to a bookstore, they'd go here, they'd try to sell a few books. And then gradually, Prabhupada started Sankirtan parties, which were not, that wasn't what we were doing from day one. Prabhupada said, you should go out every day, at least an hour. And when you go out, bring these books or back to Godhead and try to sell, you know, first it was like back to Godhead, okay. People will, Prabhupada said, any gentleman would give a quarter. So we found, yes, some gentlemen would give quarters, we'd sell back to Godheads. And every now and then you could sell, you know, a Bhagavad Gita. The Macmillan Company published that first condensed, abridged Bhagavad Gita with Vishnu on the cover. Maybe purple. Some of you have seen that purple Bhagavad Gita. Abridged edition, mostly just the translations, no Sanskrit, no word for word, abridged purports. And we sold a few of those, but then gradually devotees found out how to distribute books. That was a discovery they made on the West Coast up in San Francisco. Then in L.A. they found out that they could do the same thing. And then it spread to the East Coast. We could do it too. And pretty soon everybody was going out distributing books. One of the books that we produced in Boston was the original Krishna book, which was printed by Dynapon Printing Company in Japan, who had expertise that we didn't have. George Harrison paid for it. They printed it. And we did the prepress for it. Then another big project was Bhagavad Gita As It Is, which we did in Brooklyn. Did we start in Boston?
I know when I went to New York, I
worked. It was already going.
That, and it was getting near the end.
Getting near the end. We might have started in Boston. And in any case, we finished in Brooklyn. And the Macmillan Company agreed to print the book, agreed to publish the book. That's the whole story. I don't know if you've read in Back to Godhead the story of how that happened. I won't tell the story, but it basically, sort of miraculously, they were looking for a Bhagavad Gita to publish, and we were looking to publish Bhagavad Gita. So that worked out very nicely. We also had a Sanskrit department. Pradumna Prabhu, whom some of you may know, was our original Sanskrit editor. Prabhupada told him to learn the system of diacritic markings, and gradually he became expert in Sanskrit language, and he was doing a lot of work, first putting in the diacritic marks all in the right place, seeing that things were spelled right, seeing that things were divided right. If it's Paramatma, so it has to be a long A, but then in the word for word, you divide it up. Parama, Atma, hyphenated. So all of those conventions, all those standards, Pradyumna devised to make the books very scholarly, which Prabhupada appreciated very much. So then we came out with Bhagavad Gita as it is. And second canto, of course, was already published. Then we went through third canto, fourth canto, and Adi Lila of Chaitanya Charitamrita, and a few more books along the way, all those small books, On the Way to Krishna, Beyond Birth and Death, Perfection of Yoga, all of that coming out of Brooklyn. Brooklyn was really
cranking it out.
We were really, really going. And we were privileged, too, because we got to read the books first. Everybody else would get them when they were published, but we'd get them and read them and really be into them.
Sometimes with the manuscripts.
Yeah, we'd have the manuscripts and give class from the manuscripts, and we'd be definitely ahead of the curve. And meanwhile, ISKCON was growing. Book distribution was taking off. In 1970 already, Prabhupada was starting to give the movement some more structure. He created the Governing Body Commission, and in the same document he said, "So far my books are concerned, I am setting up a different body of management known as the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust. ISKCON Press was created for the exclusive publication of my books and literatures and should be continued in that way." Then in 1972, he actually set up the BBT. In 1970, he said he was going to do it. In 1970, he did it. He set up actually two trusts, one in India, one in America, but he treated them really like one trust. And the BBT had two purposes. The first purpose was to publish books, and the other purpose was to build and renovate temples. And Prabhupada's formula was 50-50. He gave a very simple formula that suppose the price of the book is $1. So then the BBT should sell the book for $2. And with $1, you reprint the book. And with the other dollar, you can build temples and renovate temples. And then the temple itself, having bought the book for $2, can now sell the book for $4 or however much they want. And in this way, the temples get revenue, the BBT gets revenue, and the movement expands. That was Prabhupada's concept. And he put it right there in the charter of the BBT, that this was how the funds of the trust should be used, for the book fund and the building fund. That's what he called them. And actually following that, and he explained what the book fund should do, printing and reprinting books, directing and managing the publicity, distributing my books, processing all copyrights and legal rights to my books, allocating funds for ISKCON Press. These were the things for the book fund, and the building fund should purchase properties for construction of new temples or renovation of old temples. That was the mission that Prabhupada gave the BBT.
Mm-hmm. Is that for India, building the temples, or just all over?
Well, he gave, in the document, he just said building and renovating temples. Then he explained that so far building temples, we will send all the money to India. And his idea, probably you've heard many times, American money and Indian culture. And so the blind man and the lame man, India was the lame man, they didn't have a lot of money. And India was the blind man, they didn't have a lot of vision. So take the American money and use it in India for building temples. So Vrindavan was built with BBT money. Mayapur Temple, original temple, was built with BBT money. Late Bombay Temple, Bhubaneswar Temple,
Hyderabad.
Yeah, Hyderabad too, wasn't it? I think so. Then, of course, in later years, Prabhupada Samadhi in Vrindavan, Mayapur Samadhi, more recently, Moscow temples, getting started with BBT money.
Good.
Radha Damodar buses. Prabhupada said these are moving temples. So that whole bus party was started with BBT money. And the BBT also gave loans. So a lot of the North American temples especially were built with loans from the BBT. Philadelphia temple and this temple and that temple. So many temples were opened with help from the BBT. And the movement was really prosperous because Prabhupada was emphasizing sell books, and you get everything. You distribute your philosophy, you make publicity, you get money, you build temples, you print more books. So we were following that instruction, and we were doing really very well, distributing lots and lots of books, building the first temples in India, purchasing temples in North America. That was what was going on.
Mm-hmm. Can I just comment on how young everybody was?
Oh, yeah, please.
Early days. I mean, like, you were setting up this whole book production thing, and what were you, like, 20 or something?
Yeah, I was about 20.
And I remember talking to Radha Balaba, and he was saying that he went to Japan and was talking to, you know, businessmen at Dynapon and negotiating deals, and he was, like, 21 or something. Yeah. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, there wasn't anyone there who was over, like, 23 working at the press. I can't even, I'm just saying that to be safe. But probably, you know, 18, 19, 20, 21, that's where we all were.
No experience. Figuring it out as you went along.
Yeah, we were just, and we would, you know, whatever we had to know, we would find out. We would talk to suppliers, we would talk to printers, we would talk to, at one point, who knows Dukkha Huntree? You know Dukkha Huntree. We went over to Princeton University Press to see if we could learn something. And we learned that there was this girl there who was really interested.
Who could type.
So she came and joined us, but we picked up this system of proofreading from Princeton University Press. Proofreading was usually done this way in the printing industry. Somebody sits there with a manuscript, somebody sits there with a typeset copy. You read and I look. And you read every punctuation mark. You read every punctuation mark, every new paragraph, everything. And I'm reading along and seeing if it all matches. That's actual proofreading. It's not just eyeballing and say, well, looks like it's spelled right. You would actually have to do it that way. We picked up something from Princeton that you could do it, you could separate the people, you could dictate it on a tape recorder. And then you could just sit, one person could sit with the manuscript and listen. And that would save time also because you could stop, you could take a break, a girl could read and a guy could do the proofreading. So it worked out really well. So all sorts of stuff we would pick up as we went along. And printers would teach us stuff and we became quite good, actually. We won some printing awards and design awards. We picked up, Indra Pramada who's in Alachua. He was a professional designer out there in the 38, 32nd Street to 45th Street East, where all the design places were. And he became interested in Krishna consciousness, and he immediately up-leveled everything because he was professional. We were like, we would do what we thought looked cool. But he was professional, and when he joined, he just up-leveled the Back to Godhead and made it really good. Prabhupada spontaneously wrote him a letter appreciating his design. So we were just running on devotional energy, and that's how it was going on. Sometimes, as we got going, some of the centers thought that it would be a good idea to print literature themselves. That way they could cut out the middleman, you know, instead of printing a book for $1, BBT marks it up for $2, Temple sells it for $4, they could print it for $1. And then they would get $3. So it was a very good idea. And here's how Prabhupada responded. He wrote a letter in March of 1974 to all ISKCON centers. My dear disciples, please accept my blessings. Now that our ISKCON is growing into a huge worldwide organization, it has come to my attention that sometimes centers are printing my literature taking collection and spending all outside the jurisdiction of the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust. This must not go on. I specifically formed the BBT to invest in it exclusive rights for the printing of all literature containing my teachings, writings, and lectures. In this way, the collections are to be divided 50% for printing new books and 50% for construction of temples. The BBT can authorize a center to print, as in the case of foreign translations, with the agreement that when the foreign printing becomes financially solvent, they will pay royalties to the BBT. But all printing of ISKCON literature must be by the BBT or under their sanction and approval. If temples print independently, it will be at the cost of the books I am myself printing and could eventually cause the financial ruin of the BBT, meaning I could not order new books from the printer or have sufficient funds for construction of temple projects. I trust this is now clear and you will all do the needful. If you have any questions in this matter, you can write me directly or consult with the GBC representative. Your ever well wisher, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. So that was Prabhupada's direction about that. Any questions so far? Okay. So Prabhupada was, you know, spiritually on top of things, and he was also managerially and financially seeing how things should be organized. In 1975, the press moved to L.A. We had more facility, and we just purchased in New York phototype sending equipment, which is now another ancient technology. But back then, it was a wonderful thing. There were computers. Computers were really great things. I'll tell you about that in a second. But anyway, I went all over New York City looking at every phototype setting machine that had been manufactured, going to all the typesetting shops, attending conventions in Chicago and here and there, talking to every vendor and looking at all the different machines and thinking about what would work for us. And it had to be able to set the diacritics and it had to... Okay. So we finally got this one machine, which was really great. Phototype meant that there was a film strip spinning and they'd shoot a light through it and it would hit photosensitive paper and you'd develop the paper and everything would be there. The type that you had gone setting by hand would now be developed by a photo typesetting process. And it was all run by a computer, which was a wonderful thing. The computer was about this high, you know, big rack kind of a thing. And it had flashing lights and all of that, and little buttons so that you could put things into different registers, change the instructions. And it had a lot of memory. It had these big boards about this big, which were really, they were a little expensive, but they were worth it because each one of them gave you an extra 8K of memory. And we decided to splurge. We got 16K.
Wow.
Was that the redactor?
Yeah, it was actually, this was a technology that was actually a little bit ahead of the curve. Most of the companies back then were using paper tape. They had these little keyboards that would give you a display of the last 20 characters you'd type. And then you'd say, okay, that's fine, and it would knock out some paper tape. And you get this big reels of paper tape, and then you put it into your phototype setting machine, and it would go. And that's what practically all over New York City, all the best places were using. But we found this one company that had a better idea. This one woman had started a company using basically the same sort of Selectric machines we'd already used, the IBM machines. Not justifying, just heavy-duty typewriters, but hooked up to a record, like a tape recorder, practically. So it used to come out with tape cassettes that would have all of your data on it. And it was sequential, so you could it wasn't random access, but it was sequential. You could move ahead. You could correct things on the tape itself. You got a hard copy printout while you were doing it, and you could do things very easily with a command. You know, slash I was actually italic, instead of like for the other machines, it was like Bell G or something like that. Bell codes they had, and Bell G was this, and Bell something, and none of them corresponded to anything. But this was like slash P, and you could program it. So slash P would actually give you the end of a line, indent a new line, any amount you specify, make it a bigger letter if you wanted. It was very fancy for those days. And so it really up-leveled things, and that's what we moved to L.A. with. So then we were all set up. They gave us really nice facility there. We really were happy in Los Angeles.
So as I was in Denver at the time that the press moved, was that move just because there was better facility there, more room?
There was more room. The printing was being managed from the West Coast, and the idea was put everything together and manage it all in one place. Okay. And just pool all of our energy. And there really was better facility when we got there. We were really well taken care of. And the Los Angeles Temple was really booming then. It was fantastic, great kirtan, great classes. And so we all moved out to L.A. And shortly after, Prabhupada came to L.A. And we took him on a tour of the press. He had some sannyasis with him. Maybe you've seen even a picture of that. He's got some sannyasis with him. He's coming to every... And everybody's going to be in his station, and then Prabhupada's going to come in and see what you're doing. So we did that, and Prabhupada toured everything. And when he saw the typesetting room and all the computer and the flashing lights and all of that, he said that in India I was dreaming of something like this. And, you know, we were saying how it can do this and it can do that. So the next morning, Prabhupada was on his morning walk. So now you have this new equipment, but you are 17 books behind. Because he's dictating very quickly, and we're plodding along. We think we're really moving, but, you know, everything's laborious, everything's all this editors getting into things, and that Sanskrit editors and going back and forth and finding errors and fixing things and taking a long time and the layout and checking the layout. And we're 17 books behind Prabhupada. And Prabhupada was sometimes right that he's getting discouraged, that what is the use of my editing books, translating books, if you're not producing them. So he's on his morning walk. He said, now you have this equipment. I think you can do these 17 books in 2 months. And Rameshwar Maharaj, who's in charge of everything, and Radha Balaba, who's the production manager. And they're, you know, well, Prabhupada, I don't think that's possible, Srila Prabhupada, you know, letting Prabhupada know that that's just not possible. Prabhupada said, impossible is a word in a fool's dictionary. If you cannot do these 17 books, what is the use of you? So then they saw that Prabhupada meant it, that Prabhupada was not joking or messing. And they sat down to make a plan how to do 17 books in 2 months. And it involved, you know, we used to do typesetting around the clock. Now we were doing everything around the clock. Editing, proofreading, layout. At any time when your services were needed, you could be woken up and asked that, you know, what about this? Well, you need to edit this page, you need to check this page, you need to typeset something. We were just flat out for 2 months, and we did it, 17 books, including not only it's our work, but the printers. We had to coordinate with, the binding was done in one place, the color pictures were printed in one place, the text was printed in another place. It all has to come together, and it all has to be there by the end, at the end of 2 months.
It was really done in 2 months.
It was done in 2 months flat.
Actually, we heard Rameshwar Prabhu relate this whole thing in Vrindavan. His inspiration. And he said when the books actually arrived, he was in Vrindavan. He said it was supposed to be a day earlier or something.
Yeah, it was like...
One day.
one day. So we actually did it. And the order was at the time like one of the largest printing orders that had ever been placed with the on the West Coast. It was just, you know, 17 books. Each one of them's 5,000 books or so. It was serious.
I mean, each department had to be increased. I mean,
we brought in, you know.
Artists were brought from all over the world. And
yeah.
Just from everywhere.
Whatever we had to do.
Yeah.
Whatever we had to do, we did it. There's a very nice video done by Yadubar Prabhu called As Brilliant as the Sun. Have some of you seen that?
Yeah.
Yeah, if you haven't seen it, it's really quite a nice video where you can see everybody back in the 1970s, just at that time in Los Angeles, producing Prabhupada's books. It really gives a nice picture of how it was done back then.
Maharaj, mm-hmm. Did you, as I remember, the process was Prabhupada would... His dictation was transcribed, and then you took that manuscript and edited it, and dictated your edited version.
Let me think about that.
And then I transcribed that.
That sounds right.
I started out
actually just as a typist. I used to transcribe Prabhupada's cassettes sometimes. I sort of edged out Satsarup Maharaj on typing Prabhupada's cassettes. And Narayani, some of you may know Narayani in Vrindavan. She also came at that time, and she was transcribing Prabhupada. So then, sometimes the editing would be done right on the page, and sometimes I would dictate it. I'm trying to remember whether the dictation was... You were typing it from dictation, huh?
What I remember is typing what you
dictated.
Your corrections,
I probably at a certain point said, okay, I can't scribble on this page anymore, and then dictated it. That's quite possible. I remember I was dictating, you know, it's even recorded that there I am dictating. So yeah, that must have been what was happening.
Especially for Chaitanya Charitamrita.
Chaitanya Charitamrita.
So
yeah, there was a lot.
But you did all of it?
No. I started editing. I went from typist to proofreader to editor. I started editing Krishna book, second volume, and Bhagavatam from the third canto. And Hayagriva did the first volume of fifth canto in that 17-book push. And I did the rest of the Bhagavatam. I did the Adi Lila, Hayagriva did the Madhya Lila, again that's the 17-book push, and I did the Antya Lila. And then there's some other books here and there. I did some, and maybe he did some. And I was production manager for some of it. I was production manager for Bhagavad Gita, and then after that, and Nectar Devotion, I guess, and Radhabalava took over and did most of the production after that. Yeah.
We were around for that. We were young when that was happening. We got all these young people here. And, you know, we're enjoying talking about it. But I'm wondering, is there anything, some kind of challenge that they might...
Well, I'll move on and talk about what's going on a little bit more up into the present. The BBT gradually developed. First, it was basically an English enterprise, a little bit of Spanish, a little bit of French. Prabhupada said, when one book is published, I think I have conquered an empire. So try to publish as many books as possible, and that will enhance the beauty and prestige of our society. So gradually we got going. Once the English got going and we got going in other countries, then French and German and Italian and so on. So now the BBT has several divisions. There's a North American division, which is in charge of English. There's an Indian BBT, which publishes in 17 languages, Hindi, Gujarati, Marathi, Bengali, Odia, Tamil, Malayalam, Telugu, Punjabi, Sindhi, Urdu, Nepali, 17 total. And they have a few more to go. We have a Mediterranean BBT, Italian, Greek, and Dutch. And we have the Northern European BBT, which publishes in 40 languages. French, German, Russian, Hungarian, Uzbek, Russian. Let's see what we've got here. Where's my little list? No, my little list is not happening. Anyway, including Mongolian and English. So they're doing 40 languages. At any one time, they may have so many books in production. That's all run out of Sweden. The Western Pacific BBT is interesting. It publishes in Australasia, 14 languages, including, and the Middle East. So Hebrew, Turkish, Arabic, Farsi, which is Iran, Thai, Tibetan, Chinese, Vietnamese, Korean, Pidgin English. Oh, I forgot to mention that the North European BBT has also published a book in Braille. Yeah. It's like a big stack, you know, because the pages are real thick. So there's lots to go, lots of books in production, lots of languages, and then you have to work up the distribution for places like Vietnam and Thailand and what to speak of China and so on, and the Arabic-speaking countries. Latin America has two languages, Spanish and Portuguese, and this last year we started an African BBT. In Africa, there are 2,000 languages. The Bible is published in 300. There's 52 countries and 500 million people. So far we're publishing in three languages, Afrikaans, which is the Dutch-descended white language of South Africa, Zulu and Swahili. Then we've got Igbo, Yoruba, Xhosa, and other languages to publish in. Who knows what the biggest African language is? Wrong.
French.
No? Close.
Arabic.
50% of the speakers and readers in Africa speak Arabic. So there's a big challenge there.
Raj,
mm-hmm.
For all the different BBTs and the different languages, do they have a priority of which books they translate first? Because the Gita... always the first book?
No, it's not always the first. It depends on, typically there'll be small books,
yeah.
You know, because you got a small yatra and they can sort of, they can do it. Yeah. So they'll do some small books to get started. And typically Bhagavad Gita is right up there in the front. So you'll find Bhagavad Gita before Bhagavatam or Teachings of Lord Chaitanya. They'll do Bhagavad Gita. And almost every BBT, sooner or later, retranslates it. Because it's the first book they do, and then, you know, 8 years later, everybody says, oh, that's such a crummy translation. That's not French, you know. And you got to...
I was going to ask if there's some kind of quality control with all these different BBTs.
A standardization of quality? Well, we have methods that we try to use to ensure good quality of, say, the translations. Especially, for example, if you're my translator, I'll say, okay, translate me a sample of this book. Then you'll translate it, and I'll either give it back to you or I'll give it to some other speaker of the same language and say, okay, translate that into English. Mm. If it matches, good. If it doesn't match, not good. We try to have local devotees who know the philosophy nicely looking at things to see that the philosophy is coming out like the philosophy. Sometimes we use professional translators, then it's really important to have that kind of fidelity check, we call it. So these sort of protocols are in place in different parts of the world. And, you know, sometimes we do better and sometimes we have to revisit it later and say, oh, you know, that's typical. Almost all the languages, sooner or later we come back and say, do a better job next time around. We're in promotion. We have traditional Sankirtan parties, smart boxes, weekend warriors, hotel distribution is up and coming, Amazon.com, distributebooks.com. In building projects, we talked about that. As far as things going on, there's lots of stuff happening and lots more stuff that's not happening that needs to happen. The whole publishing industry is going completely digital. The days where you give a printer a manuscript or give him a photo-ready copy or give him negatives are gone. It's all PDF files or something beyond that. So everything has gone digital, and the BBT is gradually going digital also in various ways. A few years ago, we started Krishna.com to develop an online capability for the BBT. How many of you logged on to Krishna.com at one time or another? Yeah. How is it? I don't know if I should ask. How is it? Okay? Kind of okay? In need of improvement? Yeah. That whole thing is run just about entirely by young people. It's got, actually, when I go in there, to their, they're all in one little double-wide motorhome on in the cow fields in Alachua. And it's really like the 1970s atmosphere from the old ISKCON press days. It's all young people. There's a couple of old goats working there and things like accounting and so on. But practically everyone is second-generation devotees, and they are fired up. They are really into it. There's 17 devotees. The people in charge of the project now, the oldest devotee moved on, and it's all young guys. Manu's in charge of a lot. There's a girl, Radha, who's in charge of the whole store, who's sharp as a tack, really good. And there's 17 devotees working in the store, including, you know, answering the phones, sending out the orders, designing the pictures, the whole thing. And the rest of the site is done by really three people. Manu, Udhi, Abhay, and Kendra. Okay, four people. They're doing the whole rest of the site. So it's a small, tight crew, except that some things are, people are helping from other places, they're contributing. The whole food section is done by somebody in Australia. Live Help, maybe you've seen, run by one girl out of China, mainland China,
Gopi Gita.
She coordinates all the live helpers and keeps everybody fired up and so on. She's working out of mainland China, and live helpers are all over the place. When they first proposed live help, I said, oh, it's going to be so personnel intensive, and, you know, come on. And he said, and it's been fantastic. But there's lots to do there. It needs IT geeks, it needs design people, it especially needs editorial people, people who can write, people who can communicate in web mode. It needs architects, you know, what is it called? Information architecture. Lots to do on that side. Among other things going on, we have the Sanskrit school in Vrindavan for people, so, you know, it's not going to come to an end and we won't be able to translate any more books because no one will know the language. We've had a lot of bright young, not a lot, but a good handful of bright young people learning Sanskrit directly from Gopi Pranadana Prabhu, who's our chief translator. We've had Vrindavan art seminars, another one's taking place this year with young artists training under our veteran BBT artists, Dhriti and Ramdas. We've got the archives, which I think you'll see the day after tomorrow. They're planning a tour, so you get to see what's going on there. That's all, again, three people. Three aging people. Three people who are going to die sometime and create a big vacuum. So there's definitely room for taking over, really, the work of Bhaktivedanta Archives, especially since Bhaktivedanta Archives is no longer just keeping things in boxes. It's going all digital. So everything is going to be, we have another project called the Digital Repository Project, aimed at taking all of our text, all of our audio, all of our pictures, all of our manuscripts, all of our everything, putting it in digital form, meta tagging it so you can find everything, making it XML so that you can translated into ebooks or iPod apps or whatever it is that you want to do, so that, you know, we have the flexibility and the capability that we need to accomplish our mission. It's no longer just putting things on shelves.
I have a question. If, say, for instance, some of our youth here are interested in that, I know they're all young, they're not married. So when one thinks about getting married, they also think, I have to, you know, have to support a family. So is that possible if they're if they decide to?
There's two ways that's possible. It's an interesting question that the BBT is grappling with. Prabhupada said, strictly, no one in the BBT should get a salary. How did we work? We have one householder, Madhusudan, who was working. He started actually in New York. Now he's in California. And I recently interviewed him. I have a little project interviewing devotees who are back there getting a little oral history. And he told me that he had, when he was working for the BBT in LA, he had an apartment, prasadam, for he and his wife and his little daughter, and $12 a month. We lived very simply. I mean, this is...
We
were
happy.
You know, I mean, we just cut it down to what absolute, you know, like, yeah. Charu's talk was there this morning. We cut it down to what we really needed, and we were just really focused on service. And, you know, we were fine. I have an apartment, I have food, and I have $12. What more do I need? So those of you who are into cut it tight and just do it for Krishna and depend on Krishna, that's there. Otherwise, we have to think about what to do. And yes, we do in year 2000 and such realities, we do provide some stipends for people, but we really do cut it tight. Some people work by, you know, they get their money outside and then they just donate their time for the BBT. That's one way to do it. Others, you know, live pretty simply. Ekanath and his wife are just living in the archives building, you know, amidst the whatever else. You'll see what's there. So they're sharing a room with a collection of stuff. So there you are. One thing the BBT needs to do is fundraising, because you'll see, like, the archives, it really can't support itself by selling stuff. That just doesn't work for what they're doing, for a variety of reasons. But and we really don't want to sell this stuff. Mostly we want to just make it available. So selling stuff doesn't really support the archives. But people, I'm sure, are willing to donate for the mission of the archives. But somebody has to go out there and put their hands out. And the people who are working the archives are mostly artists. You know, they're people who are really very good at their archival work and at their photographic work and at this, you know, beautiful stuff they do, but they're not really, not so expert at and really don't want to go out there and beat the pavement looking for donations. Anyone who can develop an expertise in fundraising has a very good career ahead of them, let me tell you. Anywhere in ISKCON, anywhere in the BBT, anywhere in the world, if you learn the art of turning words into money, you will be welcome. And it's a science. It's not a great secret how to do it. There are standard things that you do. And I've met people who, you know, they're just people, you know, they're just, you know, a girl who, you know, I used to be an accountant and then I got into and, you know, and now I'm raising, about $3 million a year. Yeah, you know, it's just systematic, methodical, getting a lot of names and writing a lot of letters and writing a lot of thank you notes for $5 and $10 and $20. And over time, it becomes a steady group of supporters who can do wonders for you. It requires patience, it requires learning, requires enthusiasm, requires a little bit of expertise in the English language, requires learning something about techniques. Anyone who's looking for that job will find that they will cost justify their rice knowledge potties. That's an open, a very open spot in the BBT right now, fundraising spot. And there are a number of others. I'm just finishing up. Let's see what else. We have a need for writers, for editors, for designers, marketers, anyone who wants to get into marketing. That's a very open spot. Really needs a lot more done there. Publicity, someone who wants to, you know, that so many messages that need to get out, and, you know, the old aging 1970s guys are not the guys to do it. We need IT geeks, and above all, we need new trustees. Anyone who wants to take my job, come speak to me afterwards. Really, it's, you know, it is yours for the taking. I'm not going to hold on to my post for eternity. I'm going to go. Probably I'll be incompetent for the post before I'm kicked out of the world. So I'm ready at any moment for anyone who wants to learn what's involved and take it over. Brahma Muhurta Prabhu, who's perhaps our most productive trustee right now, who's producing in 40 languages, was, you know, the assistant to a trustee. You know, young, energetic guy. Now he's in charge of the whole thing. So I would prefer that before the vacuum is created by my death or decrepitude, somebody else step forward to, from among all of you, to take on the job. Oh, I brought some gifts for everybody. I almost forgot. If you haven't seen this DVD, this is another thing that Brahma Muhurta has been busy with in Northern Europe. For the previous Sankirtan Marathon, he produced this DVD of many separate videos. It's got some, it's all video clips, some video clips of Srila Prabhupada, some video clips of senior devotees talking about book distribution, some video clips of devotees doing book distribution in different parts of the world. It has a beautiful video also done by Brahma Muhurta of the Vrindavan art seminars. It's got a large section about the editing of Srila Prabhupada's books with video clips about that. Something I'm leaving out. Oh, it's got a fantastic video about how book distribution got started in the former Soviet Union. So it's really, I think it's pretty cool, and hand them out. And it runs on a Mac or a PC. A lot of Mac users out there? Yeah, okay. Any questions?
In current times right now, I think the Bhagavad Gita that we have now, the most recent one, has an orange cover on it. I think it's the second or third edition.
Second edition. There is no third edition.
Oh, okay. So what, between the editions, what, from what I've heard, I think it's that it's, the difference in the editions is people go back and listen to the tapes that Prabhupada said, and then they said, oh, wait a minute, we actually missed something. Is that kind of, what are the actual differences?
The actual tapes are only there for the introduction to Bhagavad Gita as it is. There's no other tapes. For the introduction, that's exactly what we did. I went back and listened to the tape, and where something significant was left out, I put it back in. We also fixed some, you know, spelling errors, some Sanskrit errors, a few things that have been misunderstood. For the rest of the book, we have manuscripts at various stages of production. For some, we have the first six chapters. They were typed by Prabhupada himself, so it seems. And we have those manuscripts. Maybe you'll see something Sunday. For the next, after that, from right toward the beginning of chapter 7, Prabhupada starts dictating. And then, whoa, it's a whole different game. Because people have to hear what Prabhupada's saying, and they don't always get it. They really blow a lot of it. They get a remarkable amount of it right, and a fair amount of it wrong, especially when it comes to Sanskrit and even English, sometimes just not getting it. They also sometimes don't quite understand the philosophy, or they don't realize what quotation Prabhupada is giving and translating. So there are a lot of errors, omissions, errors in the first edition of Bhagavad Gita as it is. Sanskrit mistakes, plus a lot of the translations were sometimes Prabhupada's and sometimes borrowed. Hayagriva Prabhu, who is the editor, explained that with Prabhupada's permission, he sometimes just borrowed other people's translations because it was easier to do than taking the, you know, what Prabhupada had said and make it into good English. There, here was this good English already out there. But that creates some problems. Sometimes the translations are a little Mayavadi. Lots of times they don't match Prabhupada's word for word because they were, you know, it's Dr. somebody or other's translation, not Prabhupada's, and so the word for word don't match. Or sometimes what Prabhupada's saying in the purport doesn't register with what's in the translation because, again, it's taken from a different place. So as we were moving down the line in the late 1970s, early 80s, devotees started complaining. You know, this something's left out. Bhava Mad Bhakta, it doesn't say become my devotee. It's left out of the translation. And this isn't right, and that's not right. You should fix this, you should fix this. So finally I just took the whole thing in hand, went through the whole book, looked at all the manuscripts that we had, went through everything, and revised it all. And I sent out the revised translations to just about everybody and said, hey, we're going to revise all the translations, check it out beforehand, I don't want to go back and say, you know, what about this? You know, while it's still on my desk, look at it all. And the purports I didn't do that with. It was too much. It was like 1,000 pages of text. And this is all in the photocopy days. There was no, you know, put it on your Facebook thing. It meant sending packages out. So we did all that, and that's the second edition. There's subsequently been some controversy about it. Some of it really ill-motivated. You know, there was somebody who made a big legal case, basically because he wanted to be the trustee of the BBT. At the same time, he was being arrested for driving under the influence, we later found out. And he's making a big moral case about, you know, we have to follow Prabhupada's instructions and publish his books as they are. And meanwhile, you know, this is going on. In the next few weeks, we're going to be doing something interesting. I did my editing for the translations on separate pages, you know, all typed separately. But the purports I just did right in the book. I just scribbled the corrections right in there. And then after the book was produced, the second edition, that copy got lost. Nobody knew where it was. You know, I was traveling. I'd taken sannyas. I was traveling around, and the book's supposed to be in Los Angeles, but nobody knows where it is. 3 years ago, Dravida Prabhu in San Diego was looking through a trunk, and he found it. And recently it's been digitized. And in the last, well, I'm right now in the process of going through it and making comments on it, explaining what the different changes were. Well, you can see the changes, but why the different changes were made. In some cases saying, here's what the original manuscript says. In some cases saying, here's what the grammatical rule is. And we're going to publish online the whole copy, that whole Bhagavad Gita first edition with my editing on it and my notes and also a Sanskrit editor's notes. He's gone through the word for word and made some comments also. So all the people who are, you know, have something to say about they changed this, they changed that, will be much better informed. Whichever side of the issue you're on, you'll know a lot more about what happened. And I think that may have an interesting effect on the discourse.
So do you think this will be the final pass? So there's not going to be a third edition that you're going to go back and find other stuff, or is this...
Well, there's always more stuff. Yeah. It's amazing. When I was going through the second edition, here and there, I would find something. A Sanskrit quotation where, when I looked at it, I saw, no, that's not what it was. It's this. But it's starting to get pretty small. We're not finding, you know, major stuff. All of our books, actually, we keep finding something. It's the nature of publishing, that there's always something. You need to proofread something 7 times, and still...
it's like... Period.
Any of you who work with computer programs, okay, so you know what it is. You know, you go through it 100,000 times, and still there's a damn bug in it. And usually, if you've done your work well, it's a small bug, and you can fix it. But they're like bugs. You can't... Yeah, they keep finding them. So we keep finding bugs in our English books. We even have a conference called Errors in English Books, where anyone can write in and say, hey, it looks to me like an error. And quite often it is, especially in books that were done during the 17-book rush. There are quite a lot of things there, you know, even like sometimes the Sanskrit, the Devanagari is left out, it's just missing. Sometimes the words are spelled wrong. There's lots of things. Dravida Prabhu recently went through the Krishna book and Chaitanya Charitamrita. He revised them quite carefully with reference to the original stuff. And his revisions come to, it's printed actually in the book, what percentage of the text he actually had to revise. And it's really quite a small percentage. The only book that required really extensive work, well, I shouldn't say the only one, because Nectar of Devotion also, had fairly extensive stuff done to it, but not so much. But Bhagavad Gita, because it was done so early, because of the way it was done before, like once we got Bhagavatam going, we were pretty professional. We were, you know, by that time we had systems for doing things. We went over things and checked things, and we were really a pretty together batch. How many of you have seen Happiness on Second Avenue? You know, where high on a low platform and low on a high platform and all that? That was the time when Bhagavad Gita as it is was edited.
We're just coming out of
so, yeah, I mean, it's like we were, you know, the ground was still shifting under our feet, and and we're editing these books. So there are a lot of things that needed to be done there, and there's still the little stuff is still there for other books, and we keep trying to catch that little stuff, especially since it's our foreign language translators that find most of the errors these days, because when you're a translator, you really have to focus. I'll give you an example. One translator. She came across this place, it's in Krishna book, where Krishna's entering Mathura. He's come from Vrindavan, he's entering Mathura. And Mathura is described, and it's surrounded by cannons.
Oh, yeah.
Mathura city is surrounded by cannons. And she thought about this, you know, she's a translator, she's, you know, what's this cannons? Like 5,000 years ago, Mathura's, you know, cannons, you know, I mean, could be, but... So she went to Govinda Madhava, who is the production manager for, I think it was Polish, and do we have the original tapes for this? You actually dig out the original tapes, so they listen to the tapes, and Prabhupada says, cannels. Canals. So... So that's what it was. There's another one. I'll just give one more example. This was also found by a translator, that also from Krishna book, that once in the city of Dwarka, there was, once in the city of Kashi, in the barricades, within the barricades of Varanasi, there was a severe drought. Okay. Once within the city of Kashi, within the barricades of Varanasi, there was a severe drought. What's wrong with that? Huh?
The same name.
It's the same place, yeah. Kashi and Benares and Varanasi are the same place. So the same translator, I think, she said, wait a second. Something's got to be wrong here. So they went back, original tape, once within the city of Kashi, within brackets, Varanasi. Yeah.
Raj, in one of the books I was reading, it said you can send your children to our Gurukul in Dallas.
Yeah.
And like that, obviously, like there's no more Gurukul there.
Yeah.
So like, what would be done about that?
Probably we leave it.
Really?
Because at the time the book was written, there was a Gurukul in Dallas, and we'll leave it up to the reader to adjust that, well, there may not be a Gurukul in Dallas anymore. Just like Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, in his Chaitanya Charitamrita, you know, all these villages and places, he says, and to get to this place, you get on this train, and you go here, and you go there. A lot of those train lines don't exist anymore, and, you know, it's, all the places are, it's a whole different story. But, you know, it's left, because that's what he wrote. For something like that, we probably would leave it. Yeah. By the way, I have a whole seminar on book editing and comparing this and that. If anybody wants me to, you know, if there's a popular demand or something, I can give that seminar. Otherwise, I'm just giving, you know, a few minutes. There is a site, however, bbt.info, and there's a page, three pages there, called Gita Revisions Explained, where you can see most of the things that have been brought up, where people have said, blah, 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 blah. You can find most of them with the old edition and the new edition and what the manuscript said, side by side, which you wouldn't find any place. Usually they look at the old edition, they look at the new edition, they say it's changed, and they go ballistic. So on this page, you can see all three together. You can get there also from my site, jswami.info. Click on the editing link and you'll get to all this stuff. And there's a new site coming up. It's in beta, called bbtedit.com, where there's a lot of stuff. You can, it's beta, but you can go there and you can pick up a lot. There'll be a lot of videos there, a lot of the same stuff, in fact, that's on this DVD. And that's where we'll be posting these, the edited, scribbled on copy of Bhagavad Gita as it is, which I think will be very interesting. We'll do it in stages, one chapter after, you know, as I can get to it. That'll start coming pretty fast, I think, after a couple of weeks. Anything else? We're done. Yeah?
Yeah, is there any kind of organization of youth outside of retreats?
In terms of BBT work or organization of youth, in which way?
Like connecting and discussing between the youth and what they're doing and what we're doing, and just and
there
trying
are some,
to solve like
there's
public relations issues.
There's an ISKCON youth ministry, maybe, which is still going on. I'm not quite sure. Is it still going on? It's still going on. There's gurukuli.com website. Is that still where most of second gen people are? Gurukuli.com?
No.
Facebook. It's all Facebook. Forget it. Gurukuli. It's all Facebook. Is there a place on Facebook, or is it just everybody's out there?
Basically, your friends add each other, and then you got suggestions of friends.
Okay, so there's a network there. Get on Facebook and find out where some of your friends are who are on this retreat, or who you know from different parts of the society, and get in the network that way. There's a lot of people who get together in Vrindavan and Mayapur. There are youth festivals that happen at different times, especially in the summer. Kuli Mela coming up in LA. If you want to get on Premanjana's yellow bus and head out to, okay, two spots still left. I'm too old to know many other answers. I don't know. Okay. Okay. Thank you all very much. Hare Krishna. Shri Prabhupada ki jai. I didn't talk much about book distribution today, but book distribution is a lot of fun. That's your class. Okay. Parthasarathi is getting into book distribution tomorrow.
About Nectar of Devotion. That is such an advanced book.
Yeah.
And it was one of the very first books that was published. That always puzzles me. It's like the Prabhupada made the decision to do that. It's so advanced.
It is.
Well, spider on you.
Oh.
Spider on you. A big one.
Oh, yes. Okay. Well, one thing is Prabhupada placed a lot of emphasis on, you know, the sadhana bhakti part and that side of things. And some of the later areas he goes through fairly quickly.
Okay, so some of that was to sort of lay down the rules and standards.
Yeah, definitely a lot of it. I mean, even not rules, standards, and even, you know, like, what are we doing? What is devotional service? What is, you know, it's supposed to be a process. What is this process? He was introducing the deity worship there, and we really needed to understand the offenses, the rules. You know, it needed the theoretical and practical underpinning. I really needed Nectar Devotion.
Okay.
That's right about when it came out.
And teachings of Lord Chaitanya, that was Prabhupada.
That was like more advanced than Nectar Devotion.
Yeah, yeah.
But,
there and Prabhupada, that he like took Chaitanya Charitamrita and condensed it into teachings of Lord Chaitanya?
No, he pulled certain sections. The Ramananda Samvad, discussions with Ramananda Roy, discussions with Sanatana Goswami, discussions with Rupa Goswami. My personal theory is that in the beginning, Srila Prabhupada had sort of more optimistic expectations of people's ability to get it. If you listen to some of his early lectures on Chaitanya Charitamrita, it's really kind of up there. And you listen to his later lectures and you know that everyone is in the bodily concept of life.
Still, the later lectures seem more simple. Yeah. You listen to the early ones, 66, 67.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
so I think, you know, Prabhupada kind of, you know, he landed, he started teaching, and then after some time he kind of got to see where people were at, what they could understand, what they could grasp, what level they would come to, what they most needed. And so he adjusted. And so you hear, you know, like as you said, the later lectures are really simpler in a lot of ways and more focused on what our real needs were. And maybe more realistic about, or, you know, more less optimistic about where we'd be going within a short period of time.
As he saw what
what he's working
with it, sort of.
Yeah. I think even Srila Narayan Maharaj, who in the beginning, so much controversy was there because he was speaking about such high topics. I think he's over the years adjusted what he's
also scaled back.
Because he's, you know, now he's seen, you know, at first he just was talking to Tamal Krishna Maharaj and some of our most advanced devotees. And, you know, in more recent years he's been talking to, a more general group of devotees and Russians and, you know, all these sort of, you know, everybody. And I think has had, he's had more experience in terms of what you can really realistically expect from these people. I think he's adjusted also.
that's interesting. Right, thanks.
I'm not exactly changing the subject matter, but when I asked you that question about, you know, how will they, if they think about it, and I was, you know, watching some expressions, you know, when you were describing, and they were, you know, this generation
doesn't get it.
No, they don't want to live like we do.
They what?
They don't want to live like we do.
No, I know.
And so I you know, where is it all going to, you know, how is it all going to fit together?
It's all going to be negotiated. It's all going to be negotiated.
Or they may be thrown into a situation where we're all dead and gone, you know, they may have to just, you know,
pick it up.
Yeah. It can be worked out. I mean, if you have a couple, one can work and one can donate their time or whatever.
If you're really looking for just a secure job opportunity, we're probably not what you want to do.
Yeah.
And it puts us at a disadvantage in terms of, you know, the marketplace. People would prefer to work for a corporation or whatever.
Yeah.
But appeal to the missionary spirit. You have to actually have another appeal. It has to appeal to the missionary spirit.
I think so. I mean, I'm from that old school. You know, when a person comes and says, you know, I'd really like to do service for the BBT, and then they're talking about, you know, their retirement plan and their
requirements.
Their requirements. You know, I just have a problem with it. So I usually leave it to other people who don't have a problem with it, because otherwise the thing doesn't happen. But I feel like I'm on Mars or something. I just feel like I'm on Mars. You know, you want to get paid how much to do the devotional service? How about $12 a month, you know?
We need to go.
Oh, okay. And do you need a ride?
Nope.
You want to walk? Okay.